On the show today, Hollywood actors go on strike.
You cannot change the business model as much as it has changed and not expect the contract to change too.
Plus, minorities in Pakistan are facing increased threats.
There were three of them on the motorcycle. First, they only glanced at us, but they went on to the main square. On their return, they stood in front of the shop. After that, they took out the gun and started firing.
And later, Turkey tries to rekindle strained relationships with Middle Eastern countries, and Egypt is trying to be the peacemaker in Sudan. Today is Friday, July 14th, and this is VOA's International Edition. From VOA headquarters in Washington, I'm Steve Karish. We begin today's show in Los Angeles, where the union that represents TV and film actors has voted to go on strike. Here's union president Fran Drescher.
And we made the hard decision that we tell you as we stand before you today. This is major. It's really serious. And it's going to impact every single person that is in labor. We are fortunate enough to be in a country right now that happens to be labor-friendly. And yet, we were facing opposition that was so labor-unfriendly, so tone-deaf to what we are saying.
The Actors Union is joining the Writers Guild. That's the union representing writers on the picket lines. It's the first time since 1960 that both unions were on strike at the same time. They're arguing that the new entertainment landscape that includes artificial intelligence and streaming services requires updated contract terms. Again, Fran Drescher.
You cannot change the business model as much as it has changed and not expect the contract to change too. We're not going to keep doing incremental changes on a contract that no longer honors what is happening right now with this business model that was foisted upon us. What are we doing? Moving around furniture on the Titanic? It's crazy.
The union's chief negotiator, Duncan Crabtree Ireland, explains the issue with actors and AI.
They proposed that our background performers should be able to be scanned, get paid for one day's pay, and their company should own that scan, their image, their likeness, and should be able to use it for the rest of eternity in any project they want with no consent and no compensation.
For more, here's the AP's Margie Zaraletta.
Unionized actors have voted to strike after failing to reach a contract with studios. I'm Margie Zaraletta with the latest. The Screen Actors Guild, American Federation of Radio and Television Artists, say it voted to strike after negotiations failed over pay increases, streaming residuals, and artificial intelligence issues. Union President Fran Drescher says it was a move of last resort.
This is where we drew the line in the sand, and it's a terrible thing to have to do. But we were forced into it.
The Alliance of Motion Picture and Television Producers say in a statement it was the actors' union's choice to dismiss its offer. The actors will join Hollywood screenwriters who have been on strike since early May. I'm Archie Zaraletta.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is to visit the Arab Gulf states next week. It's his latest effort to improve ties across the region after years of tension. Earlier this month, Turkey restored full diplomatic relations with Egypt, and similar efforts continue with Israel. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The tour takes Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan to several Gulf states, including the United Arab Emirates, whose leaders Erdogan once accused of seeking his overthrow. The Turkish economy is in desperate need of income, and that is motivating Ankara to push rapprochement efforts across the region. Soli Özel teaches international relations at Istanbul's Karahas University.
The first visit by the new economy minister, Mr. Şimşek, was to the Gulf countries. Turkey is in dire need of fresh money infused into its economy. The rumors are that maybe $25 billion worth of investment had already been pre-negotiated.
Istanbul was once a hub for satellite TV stations opposing regimes in the Gulf and Egypt, but now most of them are gone. The stations closed, and Turkey this month announced restoration of full diplomatic relations with Egypt. Ties frozen after the Egyptian army removed Erdogan ally Mohamed Morsi and replaced him with Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, Egypt's current president. Sisi is unpopular among Erdogan's religious base, and some analysts say the Turkish leader had to wait for the passing of the May presidential elections to step up Egyptian rapprochement efforts. Jalel Hajawi at the Global Initiative Against Transnational Organized Crime.
The priority in the foreign policy space for Erdogan is to actually pursue this rapprochement that he has been working on for quite a bit. So a lot of the aspects of that rapprochement have been worked on. Now what's left is the official and visual formal part of it in the form of actual visits, probably Sisi visiting Ankara, Erdogan visiting Cairo.
According to Turkish media reports, Sisi could visit Turkey as early as this month. Turkey's rapidly warming ties with Egypt and the wider Middle East are also helping to improve relations with Israel. Israeli President Isaac Herzog visited Ankara last year. Galia Lindenstrauss is an analyst at the Institute for National Security Studies in Tel Aviv.
It started with the UAE, then Saudi Arabia, and now with Egypt, and also with Syria. And the fact that this is something, a regional attempt of Turkey to normalize relations, seems to give it more credibility and perhaps more sustainability.
The latest Israeli crackdown on Palestinian militants in the West Bank has only drawn muted criticism from Erdogan, a gesture that some analysts say could be in anticipation of a possible visit to Turkey soon by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul.
Australian scientists say they've developed a special glue that can be used to repair parts of the Great Barrier Reef. Researchers at the Queensland University of Technology believe that the biodegradable putty has the potential to help the coral recover after it's been damaged by cyclones, hit by boats, or suffered bleaching. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
The Great Barrier Reef is arguably Australia's most valuable natural treasure. It's the world's largest coral system and faces an array of threats, including climate change, pollution, overfishing, and coral-eating crown-of-thorn starfish. When reefs are damaged by cyclones or struck by boats, patches of rubble are often left behind. In a bid to reverse some of that degradation, a team at the Queensland University of Technology has made a reef-binding glue that eventually dissolves away. Leonie Barner is a professor of chemistry at the Queensland University of Technology. She told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that the glue should be a sustainable way to help reefs recover.
One component that we are using is actually a plant extract. It's coming from a natural resource. And the other one is a biocompatible polymer. So it has no harmful effects on the marine environment. We have tested that in the lab.
However, applying the adhesive putty to large areas is a major challenge. The Great Barrier Reef runs 2,300 kilometres down Australia's northeastern coast and spans an area about the size of Japan. Researchers in Queensland hope that underwater robots could eventually be used to help stick broken pieces of Australia's Great Barrier Reef and other reefs back together. In the past, researchers tried dropping metal structures and mesh into the ocean to stabilise coral rubble, but their use can permanently alter the reef. Sea trials of the reef bonding glue are scheduled to start later this month. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world. Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi is wrapping up a three-nation African tour that took him to Kenya, Zimbabwe, and Uganda, where he said the West was promoting homosexuality in order to end what he called the generation of human beings. And Raisi praised Uganda's new law with harsh punishments, including the death penalty for homosexuality. A Russian general in charge of forces fighting in southern Ukraine has been relieved of his duties after speaking out about problems faced by his troops. It's a move that reflects new divisions in the military command. And President Joe Biden said Thursday that talks are underway with Russia to free Wall Street Journal reporter Evan Gershkovich, who's been held in a Moscow jail for more than 100 days on espionage charges that he, his newspaper, and the U.S. government deny. This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
For years, scientists have estimated that the universe is approximately 13.8 billion years old. Now, a scientist in Canada is proposing, in a new study, that the universe could be 26.7 billion years old, about 13 billion years older than what is currently thought. If the universe is about 13.8 billion years old, scientists have wondered what explains the existence of the 14.4 billion-year-old Methuselah star. Astronomers are also considering Webb telescope discoveries of highly evolved galaxies that existed only several hundred million years after the Big Bang. Scientists say these early galaxies seem to be at a level of maturity and mass that is usually linked with stars that have gone through billions of years of cosmic evolution. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
From Washington, it's VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. A radio station in Venezuela shuts down after more than 90 years on the air. We'll find out why in a little bit. Now, religious minorities are once again the focus of terrorist attacks in northwestern Pakistan. The Islamic State group, or Daesh, has claimed responsibility for two recent attacks on Sikhs living in Peshawar. VOA's Nazir ul Islam files this report from Peshawar, in which he takes us inside a Sikh community. Bezan Hamdard narrates for us.
Tarlok Singh's family practices Hikmat, a mix of Chinese and native medicinal therapies. They moved to Peshawar city because of concerns about hate crimes against their Sikh religion in the remote Tira Valley of Pakistan's northwestern province of Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. But what they tried to escape found them in Peshawar.
There were three of them on the motorcycle. First, they only glanced at us, but they went on to the main square. On their return, they stood in front of the shop. After that, they took out the gun and started firing. I survived the first burst of firing, but got hit by the fourth and fell, after which I fainted.
The next day, another Sikh Pakistani, Manmohan Singh, was killed in a targeted attack. Daesh, a terrorist organization, also known as the Islamic State group, took credit for both assaults. The Sikh community says Peshawar is becoming dangerous for them.
These incidents have been going on since 2013. We get the news as soon as an attack takes place. To date, no one has done anything to prevent it. And it is happening again and again, and that too with the Sikhs. My nephew, Babu Sarinjit Singh, was killed inside his shop in 2018. I can count 30 such killings.
Three members of religious minorities were recently targeted by terrorist attacks in the region. One was a Christian and two were Sikhs. People from minority groups, including Tarlok Singh, have since grown increasingly anxious.
Terrorists come directly and kill without fear. This needs to be considered because it is very troublesome for us Sikhs. Everyone works here, goes to the shop every day. If this series continues like this, then people will suffer a lot.
The predominantly conservative Muslim province's chief minister, Muhammad Azam Khan, met Sikh community members to address recent incidents. He promised special measures like CCTV cameras for their safety, along with police help. Despite assurances, Tarlok Singh says the Sikh community remains fearful as no criminals have been arrested. Local Sikh scholar and social activist Babaji Gurpal Singh recently told the Times of India that roughly 30 to 35,000 Sikhs live in Pakistan. For Nazrul Islam in Peshawar, Pakistan, Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
Egypt is seeking ways to make an elusive ceasefire hold in the bloody Sudan conflict. It's already killed thousands and forced Sudan's residents into at least six neighboring countries as refugees. Regional states worry that the ongoing conflict will destabilize them as well. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Leaders from Sudan's seven key neighbors met Thursday in Cairo at the behest of Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, who is hoping to prevent the three-month-old crisis from worsening and spilling into other regional states. Arab media reported that Sisi is trying to implement binding mechanisms with regional players in the conflict to make a ceasefire work where previous attempts have failed. Sisi told regional leaders at the opening session of Thursday's conference that everyone attending the meeting appears to understand the critical nature of finding a solution to the Sudan conflict. He says that he thanks the heads of state and heads of government for their remarks to the conference, which indicate a deep understanding of the serious nature of the Sudan conflict and their interest in taking the necessary steps to put an end to that conflict. Sisi went on to say that Sudan's seven neighbors are the most seriously affected by the conflict and must unite their efforts and political positions to create the climate for a solution. The conflict in Sudan has left more than 4,000 people dead and pushed close to 600,000 Sudanese refugees into Egypt, South Sudan, Chad, Libya, the Central African Republic, and Ethiopia. Despite the absence of Sudan's two key warring parties, Army Commander Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and Rapid Support Forces Commander Mohamed Hamdan Daglu, Sisi urged them to stop further escalations and begin serious talks for a permanent and lasting ceasefire, in addition to opening supply lines to allow aid to enter the worst affected areas. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed told the gathering he hopes that Sudan will have a leader that will take the initiative to stop the situation from deteriorating further and to contain the crisis, adding that the conflict has affected all of Sudan's regional neighbors due to the flow of refugees out of Sudan. Ahmed went on to thank Saudi Arabia for its efforts to try and reach a ceasefire in the initial weeks of the conflict, and he argued that Egypt's initiative must be implemented in concert with African Union efforts in order to find diplomatic channels to make a ceasefire work. Sudan's ambassador to Egypt, however, told Arab media Wednesday that outside forces are trying to complicate the conflict in his country by getting as many parties as possible involved in attempts to negotiate a solution, making the situation impossible to resolve. Egyptian political sociologist Said Sadek tells VOA that Sudan had the longest civil war of any African country, lasting from the country's date of independence in 1956 until 2011, creating fears that the current conflict is not likely to end anytime soon. Sadek emphasized that Egypt's initiative took place because Egypt had the hope that when Sudan's seven regional neighbors sat down together and all agreed that the conflict must end because it could spill over into their own country, this could help cut the flow of ammunition and arms to the warring parties. Two key actors in the conflict, however, the United Arab Emirates and the Russian Wagner Group, which supports Sudan's Rapid Support Forces, did not attend Thursday's Cairo summit, according to Sadek, complicating efforts to resolve the conflict. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Ending a nine-decade run, Venezuela's Radio Caracas Radio, or RCR, aired its last broadcast on June 30th. Media analysts are warning that the closure of one of the country's oldest stations, along with the shuttering of dozens of other media outlets, is limiting public access to information. From Caracas, Adriana Nunez-Rabskal has this story, narrated for us today by Veronica Villafaña.
Since 1930, Radio Caracas Radio has broadcast news to the people of Venezuela. Even when the government revoked its license in April 2019, the station found ways to keep broadcasting, switching to YouTube. But after weeks without power and concerns over safety of staff, Radio Caracas Radio, or RCR, announced it was going off air. Jaime Nestares is director at Radio Caracas Radio.
Estamos corriendo alto riesgo. Y la decisión fundamental.
There are many signs alerting us that we are at high risk. We gave it a lot of thought. Is it worth the risk? Having our assets seized? Having people jailed? Is it worth it?
RCR's listeners could hear news and views, including those of Venezuela's political opposition. Its closure on June 30th was the latest in a series of stations being forced off the air. In 2022 alone, the Venezuelan government ordered the closure of 81 stations, says Espacio Público, a Venezuelan nonprofit that advocates free speech. Venezuela's Ministry of Communication and Information did not respond to VOA's request for comment. Diosdado Cabello, a senior lawmaker and member of Venezuela's National Assembly, says freedom of expression is guaranteed in Venezuela.
No, la libertad de expresión no es de los medios.
Freedom of expression does not belong to the media. It does not belong to the owners of radios, TV stations, or newspapers. Freedom of expression belongs to the citizens.
Journalists at RCR are concerned about how the closure will affect audiences. José Domingo Blanco was a host for RCR.
I wonder if they are really aware and conscious of what the closing of another media outlet means.
For RCR, a decline in advertising and a failure to secure a stable internet connection to broadcast via YouTube was the final blow.
How do you keep this radio station going? Even if the staff are putting their hearts into this for their country, you can't.
The UN High Commissioner for Human Rights and Media Watchdog Reporter Without Borders both have cited concerns over the loss of independent sources of news in Venezuela. For Adriana Núñez Rabascal in Caracas, Venezuela, Veronica Villafañe, VOA News.
And that's going to wrap it up for us today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, visit us online at voanews.com and follow VOA News on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. Until next time, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Stay safe and have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It is clear we have not done nearly enough to protect children from the impacts of conflict, declared Jeffrey De Laurentiis, acting U.S. Deputy Representative to the United Nations. This year's report on children and armed conflict provides a sobering snapshot of how conflict has harmed children, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
In 2022, the United Nations reported 27,180 instances of the six grave violations against children, including more than 8,600 children killed or maimed. We are deeply saddened by this staggering number. We are encouraged by the outcome of engagement with parties to conflict, which resulted in the release of 12,460 children from armed groups and armed forces, and hope for more steps that will make children's lives better.
Nevertheless, too many children have been subjected to sexual violence, abducted, and denied humanitarian aid, said Ambassador De Laurentiis.
In Sudan, there are reports of children who have been forced from their homes and in some cases separated from their families or subjected to sexual violence. Armed groups remain the main perpetrators of abuses against children in Colombia, where the forcible recruitment or use of children remains a prevalent concern, particularly for Afro-Colombian and indigenous communities in rural areas.
In Afghanistan, the ban on girls' access to education beyond primary school, patterns of early and forced marriage, and the recruitment and use of child soldiers have been detrimental to the physical and emotional well-being of youth. In Ukraine, members of Russia's forces have committed execution-style killings of Ukrainian men, women, and children, and alongside other Russian officials have deported hundreds of thousands of Ukrainian civilians to Russia, including children who have been forcibly separated from their families. This stark reality, said Ambassador De Laurentiis, serves as a poignant reminder of the urgency and necessity of strengthening the international community's child protection capacities, and for the crucial need for all states to respect international law and the principles enshrined in the UN Charter. Children around the world deserve to feel safe, to receive an education, to have a future, stressed Ambassador De Laurentiis. When we take steps to protect children, we are safeguarding our collective future and helping to end enduring conflicts.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.